from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a new criminal justice reform plan for Massachusetts that Governor Baker says will focus on reducing recidivism.
Prison is, as it should be, a punishment, but the people of Massachusetts are better served when more individuals exit the system as law-abiding and productive members of society.
Also, an Iraqi toddler is reunited with his family in Boston so he can receive medical care.
There was a great deal of joy, some wonderful tears of joy. It was extremely warm and full of gratitude.
Plus, author Brynonia Barry on the city of Salem in her novels.
I think in order to have the fiction be believable, you really need to make sure everything else is. And in Salem, you know, if you change a location, you know, you better say so in your acknowledgments because people will call you on it.
That's Radio Boston after this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The report on how to reform Massachusetts' criminal justice system is out today. While it says that the state has the second lowest per capita incarceration rate in the nation, it also says more than half of the people leaving jails and prisons end up returning at some point. Here's Governor Charlie Baker speaking about the Council of State Governments report.
Armed with the findings of this report, we are now better equipped to help more folks who've paid their dues get back on the right track. And by working with our partners in the legislature and the courts, we can continue to improve our criminal justice system going forward.
Joining us now is Katie Mosehauer, who is with the Council of State Governments. Welcome to Radio Boston, Katie.
Hi, Deborah. Thanks for having me.
So this report has been a little over a year in the making, and it's focusing on recidivism. Why?
Well, the Council of State Governments Justice Center analyzed 13 million criminal justice records over the last 18 months as part of the justice reinvestment process. And what we saw was that recidivism is a main driver of the criminal justice system. So you've heard quite a number of times us say that, you know, half of people leaving the Department of Corrections and two-thirds of people leaving the House of Corrections come back to the criminal justice system within 3 years. But looking in total, 75% of people with convictions have had previous convictions. So 3 out of 4 people in the criminal justice system are returning. That's a really large footprint that can be impacted by working on recidivism reduction strategies.
And this report suggests that one way might be, and some of the reasons behind those numbers might be because of probation and parole, that many of the folks who are going into correctional facilities are on community supervision. So what do you say to that?
Well, parole and probation are both great tools when they have the resources and the training and the know-how to be good tools. And that's a lot of what we saw was that there's some infrastructure in both probation and parole, and if building on that, helping them really use best practices to identify individuals' needs, to connect that person to services, and to really build a relationship and help hold that person accountable as well as encourage them to participate in necessary programs or treatments. That can really make all the difference for a person and really help someone, you know, travel a straight path rather than follow the arc back into the criminal justice system.
When you talk about programs, that was a key issue in this report. It said in 2015, less than half of the people released from correctional facilities in Massachusetts had completed their recommended programming. And a lot of this may be that folks aren't encouraged to do it or don't have the wherewithal to actually sign up for the programming. But many said there were long wait lists and availability of programming was an issue. And certainly if you look at the Department of Corrections budget, only about $200,000 is allocated for certain types of programs. So there's also a resource issue there. What do you do to try to improve that programming so folks may be able to acquire some of the skills they need to leave successfully and not recidivate? And so you can also make sure that maybe they'll earn good time and can get out sooner.
And that's a great point. So in one of our policy options, we do recommend a bigger investment in programming during incarceration. Like you said, there are long wait lists, and that is a resource issue. We also really looked at the ways that there are opportunities to expand programming. Some cognitive behavioral therapy programs can be inexpensive but very effective in helping to reduce recidivism. So we not only recommend an investment, but also an evaluation on what's really working and where there might be opportunities to leverage resources a little differently so that folks can participate and benefit in a broader way.
Any idea about costs of improving programming or trying to reduce wait lists?
Absolutely. So in the report, we also outline possible investments in the criminal justice system. And in the first year, we recommended around $700,000 as an investment into Department of Correction programming. And we worked with the Department of Corrections to really understand what they thought they would need to bring programs to bear that would make a meaningful impact. So that's a good start. And then we recommend over time to ramp that up a little bit to meet what the department feels like they would need.
You know, some folks have said that this report focuses on the back end of criminal justice and isn't focusing on preventative efforts. What do you say to that?
Well, when 3/4 of folks in the system are coming back to the system, I think looking at the back end is also looking at the front end. I think that's really critical. And really, the report and the policy options outline ways to help with rehabilitation. I think that's critical. It's about connecting people to programs while they're incarcerated, making sure that folks have programs and services after they're incarcerated in the community. And there's also a huge behavioral health strategy that's really all about helping address the root challenges that someone might have that ends up with them being entangled in the criminal justice system.
And from here, state lawmakers look at this report and then form legislation accordingly. Is that right, Katie?
Correct. We do anticipate that a bill will be filed very soon that really reflects a number of the policies outlined in the report. We've also heard really strong commitments from the three branches to pursue administrative policy to implement other policy options. And we were very excited to hear from the governor this morning that he's also recommended in his budget funding to help support the initial investments that were outlined.
Okay. Katie Mosehauer, who is project manager for state initiatives at the Council of State Governments. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
We want to focus now on another area of criminal justice reform that lawmakers are considering this year, and that's how the system handles young people. A bill under consideration in the state Senate would raise the age of offenders sent to juvenile court from 18 to 21 years old. Ashland State Senator Karen Spilka sponsored the legislation.
We are imposing sentences on young adults, emerging adults, and instead of giving them the rehabilitation, the possibility of continuing their schooling, the supportive services to really help them get on track, get back on track, we are treating them as adults before their brain actually gets settled.
Joining us to talk about this are two people with experience in juvenile justice. Vincent Schiraldi is a senior research fellow directing the program in criminal justice policy and management at the Harvard Kennedy School. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us is James DiGianvittorio, chief of the Middleton Police Department and president of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police. Chief, welcome.
Good afternoon.
So, Vinny, first I'm going to start with you. You're in favor of raising the age to 21 for juvenile offenders. Why?
Well, for anybody who's got a 22-year-old son sleeping in their basement, the science is finally catching up, I think, to what a lot of parents' experiences, which is that these young people are not exactly as mature as fully mature adults are. And that plays itself out in a lot of ways that aren't necessarily their fault, but there's something that we really need to pay attention to as a society if we want to be safer.
And is that different now than what it had been in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, we have better science now to know that there's different brain development that young people go through, that there's different developmental psychology. But also, society's just changed a lot over the years that the juvenile court existed. Back when it was founded in 1899, 18-year-old young boys were men. And now they're entering college. They're just starting on their life of becoming fully mature adults. And we really haven't changed our system dramatically. And as a result, we're getting pretty bad outcomes for this particular population of young people versus everybody else.
Well, I think a lot of people might say, you know, don't do the crime if you can't do the time kind of thing, right? I mean, we need to, you know, you need to be tough. You need to have consequences.
Absolutely. And, they should be held accountable, no question about it. This is about my safety. It's about your safety. It's about public safety.
How so?
If we can turn these young people's lives around when they're 18, 19, 20, there's a whole lifetime ahead of them of being the kind of productive citizens we want them to be, rather than getting rearrested and cycling back through the system over and over, which they do now more than any other age group.
Hmm. All right, Chief, I want you to weigh in on this because I understand you're on the other side of the fence. So can you tell us why you do not think we should lift the age of juvenile offenders?
Well, obviously, we have a program in place now with the Youthful Offenders Program where we take in young adults into the system through diversion programs, counseling, mentoring, and it works. I mean, we have 70% of all cases and the juveniles are resolved or either resolved or dismissed prior to, but there are some, there are bad apples out there. There are some hardened criminals at 18, 19, 20 years old, 21 years old, and to put them into a system with a juvenile, I don't believe it makes sense.
Hmm. You think it harms the other juveniles?
Absolutely. You're figuring a 14, 15, or 16-year-old juvenile is more vulnerable than a 25, 26, 27-year-old male in a prison, as far as I'm concerned. To put a 21-year-old into a juvenile facility just is irresponsible.
But what about Mr. Schiraldi's assessment here that what we're doing right now with young people is having them cycle through a system that then really just sort of doesn't ever, it makes it very difficult for them to get out and become law-abiding, productive citizens after that?
Well, as you said, don't do the crime if you can't do the time. But obviously, we're not looking to. There are some bad apples, and we know that. But in order to make this work, it comes from training, education, resources, knowledge. I mean, it can work. We know it can work. It's just putting the right resources in the right place.
Well, what does that mean, though?
Well, I believe that if you change the age to 21, first of all, I don't think our juvenile system as we see it today can handle that amount of volume. You'd have to put millions of dollars into that program. That's... And I don't think the state's ready to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mr.
So over the last year, we've been meeting with a group of Massachusetts-based practitioners. That's the judges, the prosecutors, the defense, the sheriffs, the Department of Youth Services and Probation, as well as several program providers, to discuss this very recommendation. So Department of Youth Services was there the entire time, and they believe, and I think the rest of the room believes, that they could handle these 18, 19, and 20-year-olds actually better than they're being handled right now in the houses of corrections and state prisons. Mm. These young people have the highest recidivism rate when they come out of jail and prison, and they stay the longest in there. So we're spending a lot of resources on them, but those jails are not really tailored to meet their needs, so they're reoffending when they come out, whereas everybody in the juvenile system is getting education. Many of them are getting workforce development and counseling, the very things they'll need not to return to a life of crime.
Chief, I'm wondering, you said that you were concerned that if you raise the age here, it could potentially harm other juvenile offenders who are in juvenile facilities. But at the same token, can't an adult incarceration experience particularly harm the youthful offender? It would seem so. And are there other ways then to improve the system for these young offenders?
Well, I believe it comes from if they are incarcerated, obviously the programs that they have in jail would help structure the knowledge and the information to the young adult into a process of trying to get them on the right track. As we stated before, we're not 100% against this program. It's just I think you need to go slowly, move forward slowly. Maybe do it year and then check the statistics for 3 or 4 years. The problem is it's very difficult to find out exactly why the crime rate has come down. There's so many different factors. So I think we need time to do it rather than just go from 18 to 21. What happens after that? What do we go to 25? Do we go to 26? I mean, I understand that they say a young adult has issues maturing, but I believe it's a matter of upbringing, a matter of training. I just recently returned from a trip to Israel where we witnessed firsthand, it was a counterterrorism task force trip. Every young adult in Israel goes into the service at the age of 18. They know that when they're 2. They know that when they're 15. And some of those young adults that we dealt with are flying jets at age 19 and 20. It's just a whole different culture. Mm. We need to change the culture.
At the same token, it's my understanding, Mr. Sherald, you went to Germany and looked at a prison overseas that you feel has a system that we might take some lessons from.
Well, first of all, I want to say Chief and I don't disagree on everything, as he pointed out. I mean, and I want to give him kudos for the rates of diversion that they have in Middleton. I don't think that's a statewide effort, that different chiefs do it different ways in different cities and counties, but I just want to give him kudos for that and say that what we're hoping to do is to sort of provide the kinds of services and supports to help improve public safety statewide that I think we're seeing in Middleton. Even in Middlesex County, though, 45% of the young adults in the Middlesex County jail don't have a high school diploma or an equivalency. If you go into a DYS, a Department of Youth Services juvenile facility, you'll see every kid in that facility going to school 5 or 6 hours a day. The last thing we want is for some young person, be they 16 or 19, to come out of a correctional facility without an education, because they're going to reoffend if they do.
Right.
I did go to Germany. In Germany, they've been trying kids in the juvenile system up to age 21 since 1953, and the facility I went in had kids from 15 years old to 25 years old. They were all tried in the juvenile court, and they could stay in that facility till 25. It was the best facility I'd ever been in. There were vocational and educational and counseling programs for all the kids, but it had nothing on the Department of Youth Services here in Massachusetts. I mean, one of the things that people in this room that came up with this idea, in which was meeting at Roca in Chelsea, those folks felt very strongly that the Department of Youth Services is a better place for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds to be rehabilitated, even while they're being held accountable, than a jail or a prison was. And I think if we were talking about our own kids, most of us would feel absolutely the same way.
Right. Well, Chief, I don't know if you have anything further you'd like to comment on that, and we only have about a minute left. And I did want to ask you about the latest information that we received today on potential changes to federal immigration rules. We heard that the Homeland Security Department is expanding the number of people who would be considered a deportation priority. I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, we haven't seen it on the state level yet. Obviously, they're dealing with it on a federal level. That's something that it's on our radar. We're talking about it at our meetings, but we haven't seen it at a state level yet.
Several cities have declared that they're sanctuary cities and will not have local police look for illegal immigrants and notify federal authorities. What do you think about that?
Again, it's up to the individual cities and towns, but it's nothing that we haven't been doing already. I mean, we've been doing our job as police officers since day one. We're bringing the criminals to justice. The problem is sometimes we don't have the resources available. If we find someone who's an illegal alien, sometimes we don't get the support. Maybe now that things have changed, we'll see that, but it hasn't been that way in the past.
All right. James DiGiambattorio, Chief of the Middleton Police Department, President of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, Vincent Schiraldi, Senior Research Fellow, directing the Program in Criminal Justice Policy and Management at Harvard's Kennedy School. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to talk about some of the immigration rules and other things with UMass President Marty Meehan, who will join us in studio. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. As we mentioned just before the break, documents released by the Federal Department of Homeland Security today show that the Trump administration is planning to expand the number of immigrants targeted for deportation. The document suggests that any immigrant living in the U.S. illegally who's been charged or convicted of any crime will be an enforcement priority, and that would include crimes such as shoplifting and traffic offenses. Among those who've been pushing back against some of the White House policies are some higher education leaders, including UMass President Marty Meehan, who joins us in studio. Welcome.
Deborah, great to be here.
So the Department of Homeland Security's new guidance rules that were issued today about implementing executive orders, those documents call for hiring more immigration agents and prioritizing deportation. But apparently the Obama administration's program for people brought to the U.S. illegally as children would remain in place. So what's your initial reaction to that?
Well, I'm certainly glad that it appears that that policy that the Obama administration had will stay the same. But my reaction is that you're still creating an environment that on many of our campuses at UMass, in fact, all of our campuses, students who are trying to get an education, better their lives, achieve their full potential, feel threatened. And these kinds of policies, I think, are not good for American universities. In fact, you know, many of our students come to us from other parts of the world, other countries, and I think it's creating an environment that's going to make it very difficult for those of us in higher education.
Yeah. What are you seeing on campus right now? I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty among a lot of different populations. Are you seeing that at UMass?
Yes, we are. Anxiety. I'm seeing that many of our students, and if you look at it, approximately 10,000 of our students are international students, if you count undergraduate and graduate students. We recruit faculty from all over the world, and faculty are concerned about it. An environment's been created. As a matter of fact, when the president's first order went into effect, we had two faculty members from UMass Dartmouth that were attending an academic conference in France, and they were detained at Logan Airport. And that's one of the reasons why we joined with Attorney General Maura Healey in her suit. So I think that we're creating an environment that that has our campuses nervous, concerned, and I think that will continue with this policy.
Have there been others affected aside from the researchers you mentioned who are part of the legal action?
Well, we have, in the seven countries that are identified, we have 320 students from those countries and approximately 167 faculty and staff. So basically, until the order, they were, you know, they really couldn't travel without jeopardizing their status. So it affected them directly. But also, when you are recruiting faculty from all over the world and recruiting students from all over the world, these types of policies make it cause anxiety, but also will negative the impact of attracting the best world class faculty that we can from around the world.
What do you say to the folks who say, but you know what? This is what President Trump promised to do. This is what we wanted him to do. This is why people brought him into office, for him to take, you know, bold steps toward immigration reform, and the system needs to be reformed. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, we'll have to see how this is implemented, but it seems to me that students who are attending American universities trying to better their lives. I just want to see an environment where we protect those students, and I also want to continue. The University of Massachusetts is now, we do over $630 million worth of research. The reason why we've dramatically increased the impact of our research is because we recruit world-class people from all over the world. We collaborate with other universities in other countries, and I hope that Washington keeps this in mind. And by the way, I would also hope that we'd get real immigration reform. This notion that you can take anyone who's undocumented in the country and somehow put them on a bus or put them in planes and somehow that you're going to get rid of them is nonsense. So I think a more realistic policy would make more sense to me, and I'm hopeful that Democrats and Republicans alike in Washington can get together on this issue.
You know, I came across an op-ed in the Washington Post recently, which argues that academics played a part in fueling working class anger, which led to Donald Trump's election. And the writer of this op-ed, Jeffrey Salengo, argues that colleges became less focused on getting students from all income levels and more focused on prestige. And so, he says, colleges became more selective, less economically diverse, and that led to a lot of anger, particularly at folks known as the elites. Do you think that colleges are becoming too elite, and it's really causing somewhat of a class divide here that may be what we're witnessing.
I think that may be true at some colleges and universities, some elite institutions, for example. But the University of Massachusetts, if you go to UMass Boston, you'll see that nearly half of the students there are first generation, first in their families to graduate or to attend college. You see it at all of our campuses, the income levels of people that come to the University of Massachusetts, and frankly, public research universities in the country is still very, very diverse. But I will admit, I would watch programs like Meet the Press and This Week, and they would analyze polls during the political campaign, and they would make it a point to say that non-educated people are for Trump by this margin or that margin. And I think there was a backlash there, to be honest with you. I think people, particularly those people in the middle of the country, were offended by that. They're offended by maybe academic institutions, offended by what they consider to be the media, the elite media. So I think there has been backlash. But what it really is about, I think, is people are frustrated that that the next generation doesn't seem to be doing as well as the previous generation in terms of the economy, in terms of jobs, in terms of people's lot in life. I do know this, though, Deb. In any way you look at it, a college education increases the likelihood that someone will be able to get a job at a higher salary and be able to achieve their full potential. So I think the answer to working class families across this country is still to get a high quality education that will enable them to get a job to make better lives for them and their families.
Hmm. But it's still an issue of affordability. You know, affordability is an issue for a lot of folks. I think full-time undergraduate tuition and fees for in-state residents at UMass Boston's, what about $13,000 a year?
About $13,000
a year. And this summer, the UMass Board increased the cost of tuition for the third time in 6 years. So what do you do to make sure that diverse public institutions can remain diverse by keeping them affordable?
Yeah, and that's a challenge. And that means the states are going to have to step up to the plate and provide more financial assistance. You know, I graduated, I'm the first actual president of the University of Massachusetts who was an undergraduate student. And when I was a student at UMass Lowell, the state paid about 88% of the overall budget at UMass Lowell. Today, the state pays about 24%. And in fact, if you look at the cost of education over the last 30 years and factor in inflation, which I think is reasonable, the cost of a UMass education actually hasn't gone up. What has happened is it stayed about the same or slightly gone down. What has shifted is who pays for it. It shifted from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to students and their families, and that's really part of the major challenge. Now, there are some other things that we're doing. We have something called the Commonwealth Compact, where we work with the governor and the community colleges and the state universities to provide what essentially would be a $30,000 to $35,000 four-year degree if somebody attended a community college and then attended one of the UMass campuses. We've developed three-year degree program. So I think we need to constantly be looking at ways that we can reduce the cost, more online programming. But I think in the final analysis, one of the reasons why enrollment has gone up so much at UMass is because more and more people are looking at public research universities like the University of Massachusetts. Because when you compare it, you mentioned $13,800 to go to a UMass campus. BC and BU are at $50,000. Northeastern is at $46,000, $47,000.
Well, so, room and board. And, you know,
well, actually, no. I'm talking without room and board, mm-hmm. With UMass and the numbers for BC and BU. So I think UMass, in spite of the fact that I would like to see the costs come down, is still a pretty good value, and it's part of the reason why increasingly people are turning to the University of Massachusetts.
Hmm. You know, I want to just get back to some of the federal policies. Your assessment right now of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos?
Well, I mean, in terms of how she would impact higher education, it's really difficult to tell because all of her experience is really K through 12. So I don't think we've seen any kind of indication of what her perspective would be on higher education generally or public higher education in particular. I have heard some comments from President Trump relative to interest rates that are charged. I think that's an area where the federal government could do much better. It's unconscionable to think that somebody could get a loan to buy a house and pay less of an interest rate than what we're charging for student loans. Some of the rates are out of control. I would hope that more grant money, Pell Grant money, would be provided to students. But in terms of looking at the new Secretary of Education, it's nearly impossible to tell what her view would be because she really doesn't have a record on higher education.
Right. And just lastly, as we wrap up here, what do you see as the biggest challenge facing UMass and higher ed over the next 5 years?
I think it's increasingly a competitive business, higher education. Students are increasingly, and families are increasingly looking in a more critical way to look at what the value is, to look at the job prospects if somebody graduates from an institution. I think it's going to become more challenging, more competitive, but I think UMass is positioned pretty well. Long term, I think what I would like to see happen, excuse me, is I'd like to see colleges and universities find ways to cut the costs, and that's going to be involved utilizing technology more effectively.
So actual training, do you think, in terms of technology?
Training, utilization of online programming, for example. I think all of that will come into play, offering more courses online, blended learning.
Okay. All right. UMass President Marty Meehan, I want to thank you very much for coming
thank
in to talk
much.
With us today. Stay with us. Coming up, amid the federal immigration debate, the family of an Iraqi toddler arrives in Boston so the boy can receive medical treatment. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. At Logan Airport last night, the family of an Iraqi toddler arrived so they could be with the boy for his medical care at Shriners Hospital in Boston. The boy's parents were concerned that the national immigration debate might have prevented them from coming. 2-year-old Dilbarine Musin first came to Boston last year after his face was severely burned by a malfunctioning heater in an Iraqi refugee camp. The UK-based charity Road to Peace made arrangements for his medical treatment here. After the first surgery in Boston, the boy's father returned to Iraq for the birth of Dilbarine's brother. And when the family tried to return for Dilbarine's second surgery last month, their visas were revoked. Eventually, they appealed to members of Congress and got their visas. One of the people working with the Musin family is Carrie Shushart. She's co-director of the House of Peace in Ipswich, where the family will stay while they're in Massachusetts. And she was there last night when they got to the airport.
There was a great deal of joy, some wonderful tears of joy, a lot of wonder at how beautiful this baby is and how well-adjusted after such a long journey. It was extremely warm and full of gratitude. It was a powerful moment when many members of the team that in one way or the other had helped to bring this moment about were there, all of them sharing in a very profound sense of, I would say really a sense of awe that this young couple and their newborn child, who is now 3 months old, came through the international entrance door, and it was a very symbolic moment of a powerful door opening, and everybody recognized that. Their son, Dilbarine, did not come to the airport. He was in a quiet place in a hotel waiting to welcome them with more privacy.
So did you also see when Dilbarine and his parents were reunited?
I was at the hotel, and I was with the parents right up until they went in the door, and then I held the baby brother outside the door while the mother and father first saw Dilbarine. And then shortly thereafter, I carried the little baby boy in to meet his brother for the first time. So then I stayed and was part of the time that the family spent together for the first time as a family of four.
Now, Dilbarine's medical treatment consists of surgery because of the burns that he suffered when a heater exploded in his tent at an Iraqi refugee camp. What's the status of Dilbarine and his health right now? He's undergoing a medical evaluation, and then they'll determine when he can have this second surgery?
That's, as far as I understand it, that's correct, yes. He's already had his first range of successful surgeries, and in seeing him last night, it was totally delightful to see how well, how strong he is, to see a two-year-old bond with a three-month-old brother he's meeting for the first time in such a wonderful way, running to get a bottle and giving it to the baby and holding his hand and kissing him. It was deeply, deeply moving to see the strength and resilience of Dilbereen, and we anticipate that he will go through his next medical treatments in a very wonderful way.
And during that time, the family will be staying with you at House of Peace in Ipswich.
Yes. As of tonight, we'll be welcoming all four of them.
And how many children do you work with like this and their families?
Well, over the past 10 years or so, we've had many, many children, most of them victims of burns from war-related fires and injuries in the Middle East. We've had children from a few other countries, and we've had very dramatic instances of children with other injuries and illnesses that are associated with the war and the weapons of war in Iraq and Syria especially.
What do you think is the biggest challenge for the folks coming here for medical treatment? And you met with congressional staffers about this just last week, right?
Yes, yes. Mm.
And what did you tell them?
Well, I told them there is a very long line of children, adults, of course, as well, who are in desperate need of medical treatment in the United States. So I, on hand of the situations of many children we've had here, tried to encourage the congressional staffers to try to make it very clear the urgency that this ban continued to be overturned, and that no bans, no walls of such a nature go into effect. There's a juxtaposition, an opposition between security and compassion. And it's a very dangerous illusion, because we know as a country over centuries that it's in our compassion our true security lies.
Carrie Shouchard, co-director of the House of Peace in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Carrie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you so much. Good to be with you today.
The unique history of Salem, Massachusetts hits a milestone of sorts this summer. It will be 325 years this July since 19 women were hanged for practicing witchcraft. Although this history is well documented, historians and Salem officials recently announced that the site of the hangings was not where it was believed to be. It was thought to be in a place called Gallows Hill, but now they say the hangings actually took place in an area known as Proctor's Ledge, and they're planning a new memorial in the historically accurate spot to mark this summer's anniversary. This story is a big part of the latest novel by Salem author Brynonia Barry. And Barry herself is a descendant of Rebecca Nurse, one of the women hanged as a witch. Barry's new novel, titled The Fifth Petal, weaves the story of the accused women with present-day research and a dash of mysticism to create a captivating murder mystery. We met with Barry at the Salem Athenaeum, one of the oldest private libraries in the country, to talk about her book.
This is great, isn't it?
It's so quiet.
It is. It's a great place to write.
The Athenaeum smells a bit musty in some spots, with shelves of books lining up along the walls, and out a half-moon window on the second floor, you can see the popular tourist site, the Witch House.
The floor's got a little tilt to
it. It sure does, yes. Yes.
Here among the books, some of them 3 centuries old, is where Brynonia Barry writes. She shows us the seat at the wooden table where she wrote her latest novel, and she tells us how it came about.
There are a couple times a week when you can come in and just work kind of silently, and it's usually poets in here, and I swear it raises your game to just work in the presence of poets.
Well, let's talk about your new book, which The Fifth Petal, which opens in 2014, and it's Halloween, and we're introduced to the two main characters in the book, the police chief of Salem and a woman who is a historian, Rose, who has been traumatized, and she's...
suffered from complex trauma.
Oh, yeah, okay,
basically.
That's good. And and in that introduction to those characters, you're telling us about Proctor's Ledge as the site where 19 women were hanged.
Right. And one man pressed to death. Yeah.
And Rose was convinced that that was the site of the real hanging, even though the historical records had said it was somewhere else.
Yes.
And this happened in real life. Yeah, explain that.
It did. I was very lucky. I think it's probably the worst kept secret in Salem, is that the Gallows Hill is not the site of the hangings. There were a couple reasons for this, and one is that the hanging bodies had to be visible from town, and Gallows Hill would not have been. It was sort of a cautionary tale, the wages of sin sort of thing. And so we knew that the real hanging site was right near, right behind a Walgreens parking lot, actually. And they will be building a memorial there. As this book went to press, there was a group, the Gallows Hill Project, which was historians. We have many historians in town, and writers and scientists absolutely verified the spot where this all took place.
Huh.
And so I was very lucky because I had written it. I mean, the research really shows you that that's true.
Right. And so did you know that while you were writing?
I did know
it. Was this something going around town that wasn't the real site for a very long time and how it figured into your writing?
I think we all anyone who's really studied it sort of knew that. But what I took a chance on was that I said there was not a gallows built ever. There were no historical records of gallows being built. And Salem really had records of every cent they spent. And so I guessed it was a tree, a hardwood, probably an oak. And very luckily for me, I took a chance and said that's what Rose believed. And very lucky for me, as this went to press, the Gallows Hill Project declared the same thing.
So, yeah, you're very lucky.
I am very lucky. But, all the records sort of led to that.
Yeah.
So it... I took a chance.
So how much did you have to use records in your writing?
Oh, a lot.
Yeah?
A lot. This book took 5 years, and I think half of it was research. And research not only into Salem's history, but, if you write fiction, there are so many historians here, you better get it right.
You're going to hear.
Yeah, you're going to hear if you get it wrong. And then I was studying other things like music therapy and sound healing and quantum mechanics and all sorts of things that figure in the book. And I think I could have just kept studying and never written the book at all.
Now, this book and your other book, The Lace Reader, and they're set in Salem.
Yes.
They deal with, shall we say, the supernatural, mm-hmm. sort of reputation of Salem, and raise questions about those things. Why do you want to do that in your novels?
Well, I think Salem is a place that sort of celebrates that. There were no witches here in 1692, but we have a lot now. And there are a lot of people who are psychic readers. And, I always say to my husband, you better watch what you think when you walk around town, because half the people are reading you. And I had a mom who was quite prescient in her knowledge of things she shouldn't have known. Certainly when I was younger, knowing where I was when I wasn't supposed to be there and things like this. But so I kind of grew up with this psychic connection. I don't necessarily have it.
No?
But maybe a little bit once in a while, but nothing I can really use.
Mm-hmm.
I can't bet on the lottery or anything.
No.
So I always try to include things that can either be theorized by science, but can also exist in this sort of supernatural level. And that's from living in Salem, I think. You're just faced with this a lot.
So when you're writing, would you say this book uses more historical records than others? And, is this the most historical research you've done for any of your novels?
Yes, it definitely is. Because I really wanted to mirror what happened in 1692. And Rose's character really mirrors Sarah Good's. And so I wanted to use to, you know, look into her history.
And is that how you started thinking about this book?
It is. I started thinking about it originally because I had pitched a book about banshees. And people said, oh, yes, drop everything and do that. And
explain what a banshee is for folks.
A banshee in the Irish culture, certainly the Celtic culture, is someone who predicts death. And a lot of Irish families claim to have one. And it so usually the banshee moans or wails, and then you know someone in your family is going to die.
And there's a lot of Celtic mythology in
there
the
is.
Book here. Now, when you were doing your research on that, tell me, what did you find in terms of that influence
here
in Salem?
Well, a number of the pagan community worship the Celtic pantheon. So I thought that would be a good one to choose. I mean, it can be Greek or Roman or whatever, but it happens here that there are a lot of people of Irish descent or Scottish or, you know, whatever Celtic religion, and so it's kind of popular. So I thought, and I do a lot of consulting with the local pagan community and local witches. So I have all sorts of people I go to for advice, you know. Does this hold true?
Yeah, you do. You run
it
by, yeah?
I do.
Yeah.
You have to check with a historian.
Even though it's fiction, you want to make sure that it's why.
I think in order to have the fiction be believable, you really need to make sure everything else is. And in Salem, you know, if you change a location or, you know, you better say so in your acknowledgments because people will call you on it. So because it's odd to write a fiction book about a real place. So I think it has to, the things that are true have to be very true. And you have to make sure, can't take too many liberties with the way a place looks or, you know, where it's situated.
And your own history is from here.
It is. So that plays into things quite well.
Right. How did that inform your writing, do you think?
Well, we have, we are related to Rebecca Nurse's family. We also have an accuser hanging from our family tree, and no one has bothered to really look into that. I'm going to do that just because I think that's interesting too. So I think there's a generational guilt that is prevalent in Salem if your family's been here a long time. So that informs my writing as well.
Yeah, your book describes a spectacle that is Halloween in Salem, and there obviously is a lot of interest in witches and the supernatural and psychic abilities. And I'm wondering how you think that balances with this gruesome history of Salem. There was a big debate when they wanted to put a Bewitched statue in the center of town from the television show. And are people, do you think, remembering that history in an appropriate way? Or how would you describe it?
I think we're a town divided, actually.
Really?
I do. I think when I first moved here, there was a movement to ditch the witch, and that didn't mean the new witches who lived in town. That meant the dark history, and that we're known for just that. I mean, we have five libraries. We're the cultural center of the North Shore, and we have a lot going for us. And people come here because of the history. I think the mayor said at that point, we had a bad 9 months several hundred years ago, and no one's ever going to let us forget it. But the fact is people do come for the history, and now we're trying to show them what else we've got. I think that's it.
And do you think there's renewed interest in things supernatural?
Well, I think so. I mean, there's certainly with Harry Potter and all of that.
Right.
And I think when you feel powerless, you like to believe. I think that's why children love those stories so much. And I think you like to believe there's some magic beyond yourself that can help you. And I think that's great.
Are there still lessons that you think can be learned?
Oh, I do. I do.
I thought so.
I think that, I mean, that's really why I wrote this book. I think it's a cautionary tale. My thought when I wrote it was, could a witch hunt happen again in Salem? They're certainly happening all over the world. And I mean in different, you know, metaphorically different ways. But if it did happen in Salem, what would it look like? And my mind immediately went to a homeless, mentally ill, you know, someone who's really suffering, who we make other. But I think creating people who are other is something that is sadly is happening everywhere. So I think there's a cautionary tale in what happened here.
Author Brenonia Berry's new novel is The Fifth Petal. We spoke with her at the Salem Athenaeum. Her next reading is in Concord, Massachusetts on March 2nd. You can find more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.